Get ready to slip on your psychic walking shoes and follow our guest today into the unseen world around us. Ramble through the tales of dead relatives who insist on having the last annoying word. Ghosts behaving badly, inspiring near-death experiences, and dreams foretelling the future. Along the way, you'll find comfort, laughter, and some spine-tingling moments that may have you looking over your shoulder. A great guilty pleasure for those who love reading true paranormal tales. Our guest today is Louisa Oakley Green. She's worked as a newspaper reporter, public relations manager, and creative director. A University of South Carolina journalism graduate, she also studied for medical writing in New Jersey and traditional astrology in London. She previously published one other book, Loitering at the Gate to Eternity, Memoirs of a Psychic Bystander. Her work and interests maintain a curiosity-inspired balance between science and mysticism. Well, it's our pleasure to talk to Louisa today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's so nice to be on your show.
Oh, it's nice to have you. Okay, so why don't you tell us how you got into writing about psychic phenomena?
All right. Well, that actually happened more than 20 years ago. I was always a very strong skeptic about anything psychic. It just struck me as superstition, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I sometimes think that the universe has a sense of humor, because I met this wonderful man, and we fell in love, and we got married, and it turned out that he had psychic ability, and he came from a family that had it as well. Now, they don't do that for a living. They have normal jobs, but they just happen to have this ability. And we've been married now for more than 20 years, and at this point, I'm tipping toward the believer end of it, even though I am a science writer, because I've just seen things that I can't explain, and through other people. I call myself a psychic bystander because I have no psychic ability whatsoever, but I just know a lot of people who do, so I'm kind of, you know, experiencing things through them. But I've always been curious about anything that can't be explained. That's one of the reasons why I enjoy science writing. Is science is really an attempt to explain things around us. And it's not quite as hard and fast as one might think. It's sometimes just as fuzzy as somebody's belief system. But I also find that things like near-death experiences and people who feel they've had contact with a departed loved one, I find all that very fascinating, and I like to write about it, and I tell people stories.
Would you contrast for us the difference between sightseeing in the undiscovered country and loitering at the gate to eternity?
Okay, well, Loitering at the Gate to Eternity was my first book, and that one is partially autobiographical about the experiences that my husband and his family had, which I shared, and then there's also stories from other people, and I also give a lot of the history of throughout the ages of many of the things that we experience today. The second book, and the first book has 100 stories, more than 100 stories from just everyday people. The second book has nothing to do with my family. There were just a lot of people at book signings and people who wrote in to me and said, I have a story, you know, I'd like to tell it as well. And so I ended up writing a book of basically people I don't really know, but who had fascinating stories. And the second book has more than 100 stories as well of everyday people, but it also has a lot of the scientific studies that are being done today on consciousness. And a lot of people don't realize that science doesn't know as much as it, you know, you might think about consciousness, and I find that very fascinating.
Well, I'm really interested in, among other things, near-death experiences, and over the years I've had many of the writers of books on near-death experience and all the stories of people who have had them. Someone told me once that there have been over a million stories that have talked to a near-death experience. So that's a lot of people who have had a similar type experience. What interesting near-death experiences have you come across?
Well, I have one in my book, a little girl who drowned and came back, and I thought it was a very interesting story. She grew up to be a spiritual counselor because it had such an effect on her. But it's an interesting story to tell. I call it Strange Baptism. Now, as you probably know, water is often associated with life and spirituality. And early on, both symbols proved true for Laura Lynn, and that was the little girl. When she was three, she lived on a river in North Carolina, and she lived in a very rural area. She didn't know how to swim, so whenever she went out the door, her mother made her wear a red and white striped life jacket. And one day, like a typical kid, she ran out of the house without putting the life jacket on. And there was a long pier that went out into the river near her house. And, of course, being a normal three-year-old, she was curious and walked all the way to the end of it. And there were some steps leading down to the river. And what she didn't realize was that they were covered with green algae. And when she walked down the steps, she slipped and fell into the water. Now, her older brother, who was trained in CPR, was playing on the shoreline and saw what happened. But it was a long way from the beach to the end of the pier. He ran as fast as he could to get her. She says she panicked for a short time, and then she suddenly began to relax and feel very calm. And then she saw a very bright light that began coming through the water. It wasn't the sun. It was an intense golden color, much brighter than the light that might shine through the water from the sun. As you know, that would be a more murky sort of a light. And she was completely at peace floating there with the light beaming down on her, and she absolutely surrendered. Then suddenly her brother jerked her out of the water and performed mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Like most drowning victims, she threw up, and water came out of her lungs eventually. Basically, her brother saved her. She was happy to be back, but not terribly upset from the experience. And she recalls, as an adult, that it was absolute bliss. It was beautiful. And she said, unlike many survivors of near-death experience, she did not see her life flash before her being revived. But being only 3 years old, there probably wasn't a great deal of life to review. But Laura Lynn grew up to get a master's degree in theology, and she's a spiritual counselor and a lovely woman. But that had a profound effect on her and the way she looked at life from that point on.
Well, I understand that you have some statistics from the University of Virginia about people who have undergone near-death experiences, which found that 86% of them have less fear of death, 82% of them possess a greater belief in survival after death, 81% became more spiritual, 78% became more compassionate with a desire to help others, 78% experience more meaning and purpose in life, and 77% develop more appreciation for life. What does that tell you?
I think what I get from that is that when you know that we're just here visiting and that when we die we actually go home, when you know that there's that afterlife, when you know for certain because you've been there, you lose your fear of death and you develop an entirely different way of looking at life. You don't live life from a sense of fear anymore because, you know, this is a crazy world we live in and it's very easy to be fearful, particularly if you watch the news. But I think that most of the people I've met who have experienced near-death experiences have a calm that you don't see in a lot of people because, you know, they know, hey, you know, I'm here to serve others. That's really why we're here, to support each other. And that really changes the way you go through your life.
Absolutely. You know, this program is called Share Your Mission, and I have interviewed 800 and something people about their purpose, their mission in life, and quite simply, it often comes down to one variation on a theme, which is how to help other people with the talents that you have to the best of your ability without really looking for anything in return. What do you think about that?
I totally agree with that. Have you
come across what your mission is?
From a very early age, I think second grade, began to write. I've just always enjoyed writing, and I used to write stories for people about themselves in second grade that made them feel better about themselves because they were like the star in it. And then when I got into high school, I was writing for the local newspaper, and I felt like I could really help people. And I basically have become a professional writer, and it also helps me. One of the reasons why I originally went into journalism was because I really enjoyed hearing people's personal stories. I think we learn more from listening to people talk about their lives than almost anything else. And it's, you know, and then they get validated because they got to share it. So it's kind of a mutual way of helping each other grow and heal. So I'd like to think that through my writing, particularly these two books, that are kind of like a testimonial to the afterlife, and that, you know, it's a very loving place and there's nothing to fear, I'm hoping that I can help people just feel better about their lives and, you know, lose their fear of death. I don't know if that could be considered a huge mission, but if I do that in some small way, I'm really happy.
Well, I think it is a huge mission. I think that people who don't fear death are the ones who are most able to live life and create because they're not worrying about dying. They're worrying about what they're doing right now. And any of us who can pass that message along to them that there's nothing to fear is doing something very good for the world.
I also think it's interesting to note that, and I mean, I get this from my science writing, that physicists believe that energy never dies. It just converts into something else. And if that's the case, and obviously we all are filled with energy because otherwise we wouldn't be moving around and, you know, be conscious, I think that basically when we die, we just shed that clothing we were wearing in the physical world and we go on to an energy existence. That just makes sense to me.
It seems to me that sometime in the past, I read about a study where they measured fairly precisely the difference in weight between a human being a few moments before death and a few moments after death. And there was a statistical difference in those measurements, which some people have attributed to the soul.
I think somebody wrote a book on that. It was something like 32 grams or something like that, and that was the name of the book. I don't know if that was the exact measurement, but the actual measurement, that was the name of either the book or maybe he did a movie. But I remember reading about that recently, and you're right. There is a difference in the weight, and also we know that anything living is surrounded by an electromagnetic field, and that's why some people who do energy healing can help you because they're repairing your energy field. But when somebody dies, that field goes away. So what does that say? You know, there's energy there and it's left.
Right. When we were talking earlier, we talked about one of the people that you wrote about. His name was David. Can you tell us about David?
Yeah, he's a really nice man. He had basically a near-death soul experience. It wasn't a physical experience, but people can also kind of hit bottom from a spiritual standpoint, and that can also change their lives. So this is a story from him. It's called Visions of Wheels and Words. Sometimes a near-death experience is not physical but spiritual. Just as with those who come back from clinical death, someone who's experienced a spiritual death can be profoundly changed as well. Now, David spent most of his life in the corporate world working with numbers. And he says, He was a very egotistical, prideful person, and looking back more than 20 years, you know, despite this, he had two mystical experiences that tapped him on the shoulder. One raised his awareness of what visions could show, and another steered him in a new way of thinking and a life mission. One afternoon, he was riding home in a van pool from work, half awake, and he saw a vision of his son falling off his dirt bike in the woods. And he noticed his son wasn't wearing a helmet. Now, this wasn't a dream. He wasn't asleep, because he said he knew the difference between a vision and a dream. This was a waking vision. When he got home, he asked his son if he had been out on his dirt bike in the woods that day, and his son said yes. Then he asked him if he had fallen off his bike, and he said yes. And finally, like a dad, he asked if he was riding without his helmet on, and his son reluctantly admitted yes, he was. It was not something he would normally talk to his son about or even think about on the way home from work. It just came to him, but it served as a warning for his son to wear the safety helmet while bike riding. So that was kind of an interesting experience for him, but not the transformational one. His second vision was more profound. One Saturday morning, he was relaxing on the couch and received a waking vision that led him to his computer. He brought up the internet and began searching. Now, he knew this time that he also wasn't dreaming, that he was getting a vision. He got a vision of a word to type into the computer, and so he typed that word in, and he was wondering, well, why am I typing this word in? What is the universe trying to tell me? And he searched, and the word didn't have any particular significance to him, but it led him to a site where there was an ad on the side, and the subject was kind of unusual. It was something that he knew very little about and hadn't even heard about before. And it was, he ordered the book. It came a few days later, and he sat down and read it. And it was a book on near-death experiences. And he said it opened up an entirely different way of looking at the world for him. Began reading other books on the topic and noticed one thing almost all the near-death experience survivors had in common. When they returned from the dead, no matter what type of personality they previously had, no matter how materialistic or nasty they might have been before, they changed. From that point on, they were compassionate and lived to help others. Now, David began to think about what he'd done in his life and what he should do going forward. He wasn't very happy with what he'd done in the past. He wasn't very happy with the way he had behaved. But we all have the ability to change, and that's, you know, that's a good thing. Not long before reading the book on near-death experiences, he had spent 9 months of self-evaluation that were quite painful. He said, it's not easy to look into the mirror and realize you don't like the person you see. And when he came out of that period of introspection, he was a changed man. He emerged a more humble person, more loving, and with a peace of mind he'd never known before. And this happened at the same time that he started reading all these books on near-death experiences. And suddenly he knew what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. He became a peace activist. He felt a strong desire to get involved in peace and justice work. And he was convinced from what he'd read in the near-death experience books and experienced that if the United States and other prosperous nations did not use their talents and riches to save the lives of the millions who perish each year from poverty and pollution, the world would experience widespread environmental disasters, another depression, and a catastrophic collapse with even greater loss of life. He said he was a strong believer in karma. You know, karma is, if you put something out negative, you'll get it back. If you put something out positive, you'll get the positive back. And he said from a spiritual standpoint, if we engage in acts that hurt other people, it will eventually come back to us. We can't ignore the poverty of other nations and fail to help those who are suffering. Today, he's involved in several peace and justice groups, some that approach problems from a spiritual interfaith perspective, and others that lobby for legislation in Washington to help people in need. He says that, you know, we need to work for peace and justice in all areas, spiritual, political, environmental, and economic. He's trying to follow the advice given in many of the near-death experience books he read. The best way to build a better world is to give love, compassion, and inspiration to each human being face-to-face, and it will create a ripple effect. That was something he said, and I thought that was very nice. If you meet him, he's a very soft-spoken, humble, really loving person, and it's just nice to see that somebody could make a change from being a corporate financial person who was very egotistical, very prideful, to a very humble, compassionate person who's working to make the world a better place.
Well, I would say that whether you get that understanding from an actual physical event or spiritually some other way, that having a transformation in your life which completely turns it around is a miracle.
It is, and I think he's a much happier person.
You talked about karma, and I've had people who have asked me, well, I know some really bad people and good things are happening to them. How is that possible? But I believe, because I believe in reincarnation, that karma doesn't have to come back in this lifetime, that it can come back in another lifetime. But the basic principle is sound. You do something good comes back. You do something bad comes back. So why not try to do as much good for as many people as you possibly can in your life? There's no way that you would do anything other than benefit from that, one way or the other.
Oh, yeah, there's no feeling like knowing that you've helped someone else. I mean, that is absolutely the most sublime feeling. I remember one time I got a fan letter from somebody, and they said, you know, I also write about pets who cross over, and I'm a believer that animals, like people, survive. And I have several stories about that. And a woman wrote and said, I was absolutely inconsolable about the loss of my beloved pet. But when I read your stories, I realized that he was fine. And now I feel so much better. And it's a small thing, but, you know, pets are family members. And we do really get attached to them. And knowing that I helped her with her grieving and that she was able to feel good and move on was just an amazing feeling.
I know how that makes you feel so good inside. Sightseeing in the undiscovered country, tales retold by a psychic bystander, Louisa Oakley Green. Louisa, how can they get a copy of your book?
Well, my books are available on Amazon.com, or they can be ordered through your local bookstore. If you want more information before you buy, you can come to my website, which is psychicbystander.com.
Okay. I'm going to very quickly give away one of my books, Freedom from Addiction, because I think it's so important that addiction is the worst disease that we have in the world, because it affects everybody one way or the other. And if we all were non-addicted, that we would have more time to be more creative and get more positive things done in the world. So if you would email me at wynn@wynnhenderson.com and ask for it, I will send you an e-book so that you can read about how to escape from that terrible disease of addiction. And now we're going to get back with Louisa. And Louisa, you have said, and I've known this, that angels have existed in almost every culture around the world. What do you think about angels?
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to argue with the fact that they have. I mean, let me tell you a little bit about angels, at least from a historical perspective. The word angel may vary in languages. It's angelos in Greek, malach in Hebrew, and angaros in Persian, but it has a similar meaning in all of them. Angel means a courier or messenger, and they are traditionally believed to be supernatural beings who act as mediators between humans and God. And I do have some stories in my second book about people who encountered angels. Angels are found in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And as divine helpers, they are also found in ancient Sumerian, Babylonian, Persian, and Egyptian writings. As benevolent spirits, they appear in Hinduism as avatars, Buddhism as devas and bodhisattvas, hard to pronounce, and in ancient Greece, they're called daemons. Guardian spirits and spirit guides are also seen in tribal cultures. So there's really very few cultures anywhere that are not touched by the presence of angels. And I personally find that very comforting, because they're there basically to help us and to, you know, keep us in touch with God.
And very, very comforting to know that when you pass over to the other side, you will have these beings there to help you. And so, we're out of time, unfortunately. Sightseeing in the Undiscovered Country, tales retold by a psychic bystander, Louisa Oakley Green. It's a great book. You'll love it. Go pick up a copy of it. Louisa, thank you so much for being on the program today and sharing your mission with us so that we can think about what our mission is and how we can help other people in the world.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You have a great show. I really enjoy listening to it.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.